Robin Roberts has had a difficult decade by anyone's standards. The co-host of Good Morning America lost her father in 2004. Then her hometown in Mississippi was wiped out by Hurricane Katrina. A year later, she found out she had breast cancer and had barely recovered when she was diagnosed with MDS, a rare disease that required a life-saving bone marrow transplant. Roberts lost her mother during that treatment. Through it all, she was trying to balance the demands of a high-profile job that often requires making personal struggles part of a public story. Roberts has written a new memoir detailing a lot of these struggles. It's called Everybody's Got Something, something her mom used to say to her.
She said it when we were young, and we would be outside and something wouldn't quite go our way, and we'd come back in complaining about this and complaining about that, and she would say, oh, you know, everybody's got something. And as we got older, I remember really when I was unfortunately diagnosed with breast cancer in 2007, and I had that moment of, wow, you know, I can't believe I'm going through this. Why is this happening to me? And my mother sweetly and gently said, honey, everybody's got something. Mm. And it just really stuck with me, Rachel. It's like, yeah, and my something is no bigger, no more important, no anything more than anybody else.
As you mentioned, you were diagnosed with breast cancer in 2007. You were then treated and had a good prognosis.
Mm-hmm.
When
yeah.
did you first hear the term MDS or myelodysplastic syndrome?
It wasn't until 2011 when I wasn't feeling quite well. And then 2012, the early part of that year, and I was tired, Rachel. I was just, you know, something's not, and I kept thinking, I'm going to shake it. And fortunately, I had regularly gone to see the doctor and had blood work done, and I was always concerned that the cancer would return.
Were you relieved when you heard, oh, yeah, it's not the cancer?
Yes, you know what? You're right, I was, because I thought, because I'm cancer, I don't want cancer again. And I'm thinking, yay! And they're like, woo, wait a minute, dial it down a little bit.
What is the connection, or was there a connection, between your breast cancer diagnosis in 2007 and your MDS?
Thank you for asking that, because there's a question about that. My oncologist at the time, been practicing medicine for decades, and I was only the third patient in her time as a doctor that this has happened. So it is extremely rare, but they do believe that there was a link between the treatment for breast cancer and MDS, for me at least.
So what was your prognosis going into the transplant? What kind of odds did they give you?
At first, they weren't quite sure. And they kept doing more tests. I had a couple of bone marrow aspirations, which are quite uncomfortable. And the doctor just kind of put it in a computer and turned the screen. And there was a graph of 1 year and 2 years. And there was a dot in the middle. And I thought it meant that I had between 1 or 2 years to do something. Or
to figure it out?
To figure it out. That's what I thought. I thought that's... And he was like, no. That's your life expectancy.
Oh, my.
And you got my attention. And I remember I slapped my fist on his desk, and I was like, okay, you know, what do we do? What's the game plan? And he handed me some swab kits and said, you have to see if your siblings are a match. And I remember my father had passed in 2004, and it was one of the rare times my mother was really upset with me. I said to her, Mom, I have to have Dorothy and Sally Ann, my two sisters, checked, and I need to ask you something, Mama. I know Daddy's not here anymore. Does he have any more kids out there? I mean, and she looked, oh, mercy, honey. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe, you know, but I need some help. I need a miracle. I'll give you a pass, Mama. I promise, may he rest in peace. I will not get mad. And she was just like, oh, mercy.
But I assume the answer was no.
No, yeah. The answer was no, Rachel. It was an emphatic no.
So all the while, you go through this transplant, and throughout, you have to balance your health issues with a very high-profile job and very public persona. For years, you did talk about your family in Mississippi, whom you're very close with, but you left out a huge part of your life, your partner, mm-hmm. Whose name is Amber. Why did you decide to keep that private for so long?
When I met Amber, I was grieving the loss of my father. Less than a month later, Hurricane Katrina wiped out my hometown of Pascrochan, Mississippi. Then a year later, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. Point being, we had a lot that was going on. And I'm not trying to shy away from it's a fair question. I know it's hard for some people to believe. Not everybody wants to be in the spotlight. Mm. Amber is someone who very proud of what I do, but does not want to be the focus. And it has changed somewhat for her. But she also realized, because she is in the book, that as a caregiver, she has her side of the story. And I was so grateful that she allowed me to acknowledge her, because she is a strong, strong woman who has been by my side for almost 9 years.
How's your health now, if I can ask? Has anything about your life and how you live it changed as a result?
Oh, there's a depth to it now. I just have a better appreciation. But I tell you, Rachel, I'm not going to be one of those, this is the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
No. I learned lessons from it. I would have rather learned them another way, not cancer, not MDS. But I think it, when you go through something like this, it accentuates, it heightens what's there to begin with. And I would like to think I was a halfway decent person, and even more so now.
Robin Roberts, she is co-host of Good Morning America on ABC. Her memoir is called Everybody's Got Something. It is on bookshelves now. Robin, thanks so much for talking with us and taking the time.
I enjoyed it, Rachel. Thank you.
It's nearly 400 years since the death of Spain's most famous writer, Miguel de Cervantes. He wrote The Adventures of Don Quixote. Legend has it that he is buried under a convent in downtown Madrid, and today technicians started using ground-penetrating radar to try to solve this enduring mystery in Spain's literary history. Lauren Freyer brings us the story.
I am I, Don Quixote, the Lord of La Mancha. My destiny calls and I go.
The Adventures of the Ingenious Nobleman, Don Quixote of La Mancha. Before the musical, the ballet, the film, it was a 17th century book considered the first modern novel, and its creator, Miguel de Cervantes, the Shakespeare of the Spanish-speaking world.
This novel, everybody immediately recognized as a masterpiece and a new turning point, but money don't came so quickly as the fame.
Historian Fernando de Prado says just like Cervantes' hero Don Quixote, the author had some quixotic adventures of his own. He served in the Spanish Navy. He was kidnapped by pirates and held captive 5 years.
Miguel de Cervantes was a soldier without luck, a man without fortune. He was a very extremely nice person, but he was a poor and he was a handicapped man.
War wounds left him crippled. A year after the complete Don Quixote was published, Cervantes died penniless in 1616. But he's believed to have gotten his last dying wish, to be buried inside the Madrid convent of the nuns who helped negotiate his freedom from pirates. Nearly 400 years later, that convent still stands with a dozen cloistered nuns inside. This morning, the nuns sang from behind a screen out of public view at a mass in memory of Cervantes. For all those laid to rest inside this monastery, especially Miguel de Cervantes, the priest said. A small plaque outside says Cervantes is buried here, but no one knows precisely where or even if the legend is true. Compare this to the church in Stratford-upon-Avon, England, where Shakespeare is buried, which gets thousands of tourists every year. Spain wants to do something similar for its own bard. So it's hired geophysicists to find Cervantes' body once and for all. Luis Avial is using ground-penetrating radar and infrared scans to probe the convent's foundation.
It's like you go to hospital, no, with a broken leg. The doctor, the first thing you made is X-ray, no? To see the information of your leg. And this is the same.
Excavations could follow. The team includes Francisco Echeverria, a forensics expert who helped exhume the body of the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda last year. He says Cervantes' injuries in life could help scientists identify him now.
Cervantes muere con casi 70 años de edad.
Cervantes was nearly 70 when he died, and he described himself physically in his own writings, he says. He had a curved nose and a hunchback and only 6 teeth. And then there were his injuries, gunshot wounds to his
chest and a crippled left hand, he says. Whatever's left of his bones should show some signs of these injuries. If they find him, the plan is to keep Cervantes' remains inside the convent, respecting his dying wish. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
Those dripping crumpets, I can see them now. That's a line from the Daphne du Maurier novel, Rebecca. And now we can see them too, stacked temptingly on a delicate plate topped with a melting pat of butter with ripe figs and raspberries and a cup of tea alongside. It's one of 50 tableaus, photographs all shot from above, and each one of food, literary food, from the watery gruel in Oliver Twist to a grilled mutton kidney in Ulysses to intricate salads of harlequin designs in The Great Gatsby. The photographs and paragraphs that inspired them were found in the book Fictitious Dishes, an album of literature's most memorable meals by graphic designer Dinah Fried. She cooked the meals, staged the shots, and took the pictures, and she joins me now. Dinah, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And I have to say, I'm so happy that you included Heidi, because as soon as I saw this picture you have of a toasted cheese sandwich, I was transported back to my childhood, to a memory that I didn't even know I had of reading about that toasted cheese.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that one, because it certainly has the same impact on me, and it's really one of my favorites in the book.
The old man held a large piece of cheese on a long iron fork over the fire, turning it round and round till it was toasted a nice golden yellow color on each side. Heidi watched all that was going on with eager curiosity.
Reading it as a child, you know, the anticipation of watching her grandfather prepare this melted goat's milk cheese over toast and feeling so cared for, it's one that's always stuck with me.
And he toasts that cheese on a fork over the fire, which is just such a great image to think about.
Yes, and I found that fork at a flea market, and I felt such victory because I thought, this is perfect. It looked old and worn, like he had used it for many years, and so I felt like it was the perfect fork for that photo.
Let's talk about another fictitious dish. This one is from Jack Kerouac's On the Road.
But I had to get going and stop moaning, so I picked up my bag, said so long to the old hotel keeper sitting by his spittoon, and went to eat. I ate apple pie and ice cream. It was getting better as I got deeper into Iowa. The pie bigger, the ice cream richer.
And Dinah, talk a bit about your tableau and how you created this meal.
I had to create it quite quickly because the ice cream would melt. But I wanted this photograph naturally to feel very American, as is the novel and apple pie and ice cream itself. So I went for a red diner placemat and wanted it to just feel really classic and simple. Then it was about baking this pie, which was my first apple pie that I'd ever baked.
Ever,
I'm not. I have never really been a baker. So I set it all up, and like I said, the ice cream was quick to melt. And I think it's just the right amount melty in the photo.
Yeah, and the pie looks like it came out really well.
The pie was delicious.
We should explain that this is not a cookbook. There aren't recipes in the book. It's the photographs of these meals and then the paragraphs that inspired them. And I am really intrigued by your image of this festival of things made from bananas. And it all springs from a paragraph in Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon.
Banana omelets, banana sandwiches, banana casseroles, mashed bananas molded into the shape of a British lion rampant, blended with eggs into batter for French toast. Tall cruets.
Dinah, I'm seeing in your picture banana sandwich, banana bread, banana omelet. I don't think I'm seeing the British lion rampant.
It's not for lack of trying. That was something I spent a sort of, I would say, embarrassingly long time trying to achieve. And it was just never recognizable. I thought it would be too confusing in the photo to have this sort of mush of bananas.
That look like a lion.
Look like a silhouette of a lion with its, you know, up on its back legs.
It works in Thomas Pynchon's mind, clearly.
Yes.
You also have some fun in the book, kind of stretching the boundaries of fictitious dishes, because we see in one picture a handful of pills next to a sink, right? You're embodying Jekyll and Suzanne's Valley of the Dolls. And then there's a passage from 100 Years of Solitude from Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
She went back to eating earth. The first time she did it almost out of curiosity, sure that the bad taste would be the best cure for the temptation. And in fact, she could not bear the earth in her mouth. But she persevered, overcome by the growing anxiety, and little by little she was getting back her ancestral appetite.
Did you compose the dirt? I mean, did you try to think hard about what would be in that pile of earth?
Yeah, I wanted to make it look like a beautiful pile of earth. So it has lots of different elements. There are some yellow petals, which are mentioned in the book, and it's the prettiest pile of earth I could create.
Yeah, I think so. If you're going to eat earth, you'd want to eat this little pile right here.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there one of these fictitious dishes, the food and the photograph, that you're especially proud of, that you think you really got just right?
You know, it's the ones that I read when I was a child, because the way I read, I think the way most people read then, and sometimes I still read now, but, you know, your imagination is ignited in such a special way. So the books that I read at that time, The Secret Garden, Heidi, Little Women, Anne of Green Gables, to me, there's a satisfaction in creating those photos that makes me sort of proud and excited as a reader, the reader that I was then and that I am now.
That's Dinah Fried. Her book is Fictitious Dishes, an album of literature's most memorable meals. Dinah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Through five wars over 10 years, Ron Capps whipsawed back and forth between being a decorated U.S. Army officer and a highly regarded State Department official. As a frontline Foreign Service officer, he was also allowed to remain in the Army Reserves and serve for both branches in some of the world's deadliest places, wartime Kosovo, Darfur, Chad, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And all the while, Capps was almost daily in the midst of death and bloodshed. Slowly, he started to lose his sanity from all the horrors he'd experienced. He was haunted by dead civilians, villagers in Kosovo, women and children in Darfur, and beyond. Ron Capps has chronicled his struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder in his new memoir, Seriously Not All Right, Five Wars in 10 Years. The book opens in the African desert. The author's in a pickup truck in Darfur. In his hand is a pistol. A bullet's in the chamber. The safety's off. He's about to take his own life until his phone rings.
When the phone rang, I jumped, startled, and nearly shot myself. This would have been somewhat ironic because I was sitting in a truck about to kill myself and was already holding the pistol in my hand. But I would have pulled the trigger while the pistol was pointed at my foot rather than my head. After all the crying and shaking, the moralizing and justifying, the calming of hands and nerves, the intense focusing on the immediate act of charging the weapon to put a bullet into the firing chamber, and then taking off the safety and preparing to put the barrel in my mouth, the sudden ringing broke the spell and pulled me back from the brink. I looked down at the phone lying on the seat of the pickup. It was my wife, Maureen, calling from Washington, D.C.
Ron, your book is really about how you got from that point, from near suicide back to health today. Your title comes from the scale you created to monitor your own mental health. Tell us about that.
Right. I was in Afghanistan, and I was being treated for post-traumatic stress disorder. And my doctor told me just to keep track daily of how I felt so that we could talk about it. So I created a continuum from I feel all right at one end through vaguely not all right somewhere in the middle, and then off on the far end would be seriously not all right. And I used this scale to measure just how I felt, sometimes day by day, but sometimes, you know, hour by hour.
There are a lot of chilling sections of your book, Ron. You witnessed a horrific amount of violence. And the breaking point comes for you in Afghanistan. You have panic attacks. You start to shake all over. You're unable to sleep. You clearly needed help then as you were in Afghanistan as a senior military intelligence analyst. Yet you were reluctant to ask anyone for help. Tell us why.
Well, initially, I was concerned that I'd be mocked and ridiculed by the soldiers I served with for breaking, for being weak. The second thing really is that I was afraid that I would lose my security clearance. As an intelligence officer, you absolutely have to have a top secret security clearance or you cannot do your job. And I knew that there were some medications. If I took those medications, it would require that my security clearance was at least questioned and I might lose it. What changed was that I had over 100 people working for me spread all around the country. I was the director of human intelligence operations for all U.S. military operations in Afghanistan. And I knew that if I didn't get treatment, if I was making those decisions in the condition I was, that I was putting their lives at risk, And I just couldn't do that.
Ron, I know from personal experience, journalism has come a long way in recognizing post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, it's gone from sort of you need a vacation and some scotch to realizing this is a serious, you know, condition that needs help and treatment. Do you think the Army has come far enough, as far as it needs to, in terms of releasing that shame and encouraging soldiers to get help?
I hope so. I certainly hope so. You know, when I left at the end of 2008, there was still a stigma of asking for help for mental health problems among soldiers. I think officially at the, you know, the general officer level and at the headquarters level, everyone says all the right things that, oh, yes, we're going to get you the treatment you need. But that may not have filtered down to the junior leaders level where things really matter among peers. I've actually talked to soldiers that I served with and or tried to, and a couple of them have come back and said, yeah, we knew you were struggling and it was okay. But a lot of them won't even respond to my emails or to calls.
Really? So soldiers you served with and know don't respond to your emails? You think there's still a bit of shame and embarrassment there?
I do, yeah. It's not clear why.
Do you think on some level among some soldiers there's a sense of betrayal? Look, you're putting some dirty laundry out there.
I don't think so. I would certainly hope not. This is one person's story. This is what happened to me. And, you know, I think individually there might be some people who just aren't ready to face what happened to me. Maybe they're concerned that, you know, it'll rub off or something.
Ron, in the book, you talk about the importance of bearing witness to war's horrors and documenting war crimes. And just speaking for myself as a reporter who's covered his share of conflicts, I would tell myself that too. You're bearing witness. This is really important. You have to keep going. But there's also, for me anyway, something overly earnest about that and a little dishonest. And I want to know from you, do you think you were also doing this dangerous work again and again in part for yourself?
Oh, sure. There was something inside of me during those 10 years where I knew that I wanted to be the man. I wanted to be the guy that was on the ground. I thought that I was someone, if not the one, who could get the story and get it back to a readership in Washington that included people who influence policy. I would also say that in many of these places, I was tasked to go and try to stop the fighting. And, you know, as many times as I failed to stop fighting or to protect civilians or to stop the killing somewhere, there were at least a few times that I did succeed.
So, Ron, you came home from Darfur, you got help, and in 2008, you retired from the State Department, and you went on to found the Veterans Writing Project to help veterans, in your words, write their way home. Tell us about that.
My personal experience was that I used writing to find the road home when medication, talk therapy, and large amounts of whiskey weren't working. And so I formed the Veterans Writing Project. We give no-cost writing workshops and seminars to veterans, to service members, and to their adult family members because we really want the family members in that circle as well. I've got a little sign up in my office that says, either you control the memory or the memory controls you. And I felt like writing was what allowed me to control that memory.
Ron Capps, welcome home. We're glad you're back, and thank you for your service then and now.
Thanks, Eric. It's a great pleasure.
Ron Capps, he's the author of the new memoir, Seriously Not All Right, 5 Wars in 10 Years.
Just a few words can hold a world of meaning. John Paul Stevens, the retired Supreme Court Justice, has written a new short book in which he proposes a few words here and there that would create some sweeping changes. His book is Six Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. Justice Stevens joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure to be here.
Let me get this out of the way first. It is hard to amend the Constitution of the United States by design.
It is, but there are those who think it should be made easier.
Well, seeing as how there hasn't been an amendment that's passed successfully since, I believe, 1992, and that was to accommodate a congressional pay raise.
Right.
Is this book just kind of for the exercise?
No, I don't think so. I think in time, what I have to say about each of these six issues will be accepted as being consistent with what the framers really intended in the first place, particularly those who drafted the 14th Amendment. And I think in time the reason will prevail, and this may surprise people who think it's too ambitious a project to discuss in a book.
Well, let me ask you about some of your proposed changes. You propose an amendment to say that the First Amendment, free speech, shouldn't prohibit what you call reasonable limits on the amount of money candidates for public office or their supporters spend in election campaigns. Now, to follow up, isn't what's reasonable different for people like Sheldon Adelson or George Soros than it is for most of the rest of us?
It is, and of course they would not be the people who decide what is reasonable. Those decisions would be made in the first instance by Congress and then ultimately, presumably, subject to review by the Supreme Court. It's quite important to recognize the distinction between expenditures to support or oppose a candidate in an election and an expenditure on speech on general issues of public interest. The amendment would make that distinction perfectly clear, even though it was obscured in some of the court's earlier cases.
Mm-hmm. So you think that the quality of free speech is different when it's directed in a political campaign than in the ordinary course of events?
Not necessarily the quality, but the permissibility of regulations of speech is quite different because it's a very strong state interest in trying to establish the equality of opportunity for competing candidates to get elected.
Let me ask you about another proposed amendment. You suggest including five short words in a new amendment that would say, quote, "the right of the people to keep and bear arms when serving in the militia shall not be infringed." Yes. You're adding those words, "when serving in the militia." What would you say to those people who say, "I live way out in the country," or "I live in a rough neighborhood in Chicago. I can't count on the militia, the police, if you please, to arrive in time to save my family from harm. So as a U.S. citizen, I need the right to own a gun." Few questions asked.
That's an argument in favor of preserving the rule that exists now, and there's certainly merit to it. But that argument can still be made if my amendment was adopted. The only thing the amendment would change, it would eliminate the judges as being the last decision makers on a question of gun policy, because there's no reason in the world why a state could not provide special exceptions for people who live out in the country a long way from protection by law enforcement if they wanted to. Mm.
The Supreme Court, your old colleagues, ruled this week that states could end affirmative action programs if they so voted. You changed your mind once or twice while sitting on the court about affirmative action. What do you think of this week's ruling?
It's a very interesting case, and I haven't completely finished reading it, but it's a quite different issue than I thought it was. The case is not about whether affirmative action itself is a good idea or a bad idea, should be permissible. Mm-hmm. It's rather about the question of the way in which the state changed its law, mm-hmm. whether they followed a procedure that violated a series of cases that say legislatures may not enact laws that are designed to make it more difficult for minorities to achieve their own goals. And the question here is really whether this was such a law or not. There really isn't much argument about whether affirmative action is a good thing or a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. An increasing number of states are legalizing marijuana. Should federal law?
Yes.
We may have just made some news.
Yes. Public opinion has changed and recognized that the distinction between marijuana and alcoholic beverages is really not much of a distinction. There's a general consensus that the prohibition against selling and dispensing alcoholic beverages was not worth the cost. And I think really in time that'll be the general consensus with respect to this particular drug. It's really a very similar problem to the whole problem on prohibition. Of course, I lived through that part of that period.
And you raise an interesting question by noting that you lived through prohibition. You retired 4 years ago,
yes,
from the court at the age of 90. With respect to your colleagues who are still there, should there be term limits for Supreme Court justices?
No, I really don't think so. I think that the Supreme Court justices over the years have demonstrated an ability to recognize when it's time for them to retire.
What about the argument about term limits that has nothing to do with whether or not a justice is capable, but just goes, in a democracy, there should be turnover in an institution. And somebody, a number of justices serving 25 and 30 years and more on the court, don't provide for that turnover.
Intelligent people can take both sides of it. I tend to be a person that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But I do think life tenure makes the federal decisions more impartial than they might otherwise be.
I cannot let you out of this studio without asking. This week, the 100th anniversary of Wrigley Field in Chicago. You were reportedly in Wrigley Field on that famous day in 1932 when Babe Ruth allegedly pointed to center field.
He did point to center field, and I... And
so you were there in the crowd.
I was definitely there in the crowd, and I'm convinced that when history and biographies are written about me, that'll be the most important event of my life that will be remembered.
I can't get over the fact that a youngster sitting there that day grows up to serve, become the second longest serving justice of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I can't either.
John Paul Stevens, now retired from the U.S. Supreme Court, his new book, Six Amendments, How and Why We Should Change the Constitution. Mr. Justice, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.